First question I have here is, this is for Scott Bowden, why was Winfield Scott the mortal enemy of of Jefferson Davis?
That's a great question. I don't know if everybody's familiar with the story, but certainly everybody must have asked themselves this at some point in time. Why was it that once the war began, Lee didn't get his chance until 14 months later? I mean, everybody must have asked themselves that. And the answer to it is in politics. Jeff Davis really didn't want to go to West Point. He was made to go by his brother. When he got out, he really wasn't enthusiastic about it, but when he was on post duty, he fell in love with a young 17-year-old lady named Noxie Taylor, who was the daughter of Zach Taylor, right? And they had a very brief and marriage that ended tragically when Noxie died, just a few weeks after their marriage. Well, after some grieving and the Mexican War came around, Jeff Davis raised or resurrected a regiment of rifles out of Vicksburg, the 1st Mississippi Rifles. And they joined Zach Taylor's army of operations that came out of Texas and went into northern Mexico. So he served with his former father-in-law. Okay? The other army in Mexico is operating out of Veracruz, and that's commanded by Winfield Scott. Okay? Now, the plan is for Zach Taylor to come from the north, Winfield Scott's army to march overland from the east, converging on Mexico City and putting the squeeze on Santa Ana. Now, there are reinforcements that are due to Zach Taylor's army. And Winfield Scott, as the senior officer of the theater, redirected those to his army. That was an affront that Taylor vehemently opposed, and one that Jefferson Davis took very personally. And from that moment on, Jeff Davis did everything he possibly could to either embarrass or block Winfield Scott's promotions in Congress, which came after the war, or any type of recognition connected to the war. The Winfield Scott, Jeff Davis feud moved into the nation's papers. It carried on for years while Davis was Secretary of War under Pierce. And it was so vehement, it was so vicious, that it would embarrass any periodical today to those letters, those exchanges. The men hated each other. But finally, when Congress, over the objections of Secretary of War Davis, approved Scott's promotion and all his back pay that was in connected with Davis having him recalled from Mexico to answer some specious charges before Congress as the war wound down, when Scott finally won his long battle against Jeff Davis, and the proclamation from Congress came through, Davis, as Secretary of War, refused to sign it. That's how deep his animosity was towards Winfield Scott. Now, ladies and gentlemen, who was Winfield Scott's protege?
Robert E. Lee.
Robert E. Lee. And during the time from the end of the Mexican War until the start of the war between the states, every time Davis and Lee's paths cross, Davis does not do Lee any favors, none, zero. There's a story about the Lopez Junta that came out of Mexico that Davis tried to have Lee violate his oath of office by giving them the support. There's the story of once the four regiments were raised for frontier defense, the 1st and 2nd Infantry, the First and Second Cavalry in 1855. Everybody knew that Robert E. Lee was the best qualified officer to lead the Second Cavalry, but instead it went to Jeff Davis's good friend, Sidney Johnston. Not that Sidney Johnston was not a good officer, but he was a pay officer, and Lee had a lot better qualifications in everybody else's opinion. But nevertheless, Sidney Johnston had an advantage of seniority in the system. And then when the war began, the Virginia military forces under the command of General Lee, Lee does not, on the beck and call of Jeff Davis, drop everything and run to Montgomery, Alabama to consult with him. He says he is instead preoccupied with the defense of Virginia. This didn't sit well with Davis. When Davis finally arrived in Richmond, when he was decided to transfer the capital from Montgomery to Richmond, there was this long procession, train procession, where all along the way, at every stop at every city, the people are coming out to the train platforms to proclaim the Messiah, they think, is going to save the South, that being Jeff Davis. And by the time he rolls into Richmond, he's let Lee know long before he arrives the day and the time that his train's arriving. And when his train arrives, guess who's not at the rail platform to meet him? It's Robert E. Lee. He's not there. He used the time to go up to Centerville to inspect the positions that Joe Johnston had and the army up there, all in the business of Virginia. Well, you can imagine how that sat with Jeff Davis. So when Virginia's military forces were absorbed by the central government on June 8, 61, Lee was out of a job and Davis didn't give him one. Lee preoccupied himself with other business until a real crisis exploded in Western Virginia with the defeat of the Confederate forces out there. Now, once that happened, Davis turned to first Beauregard and then Johnston to go out to Western Virginia to rectify things. Both of them turned him down. So then Davis said, okay, how about you, Lee? You go out there. Lee agreed. But the key thing to remember about the Western Virginia campaign, and please never forget this, is that when Davis sent him into the wilds, he sent him out there without any command authority, zero. It was acknowledged in the papers at the time and acknowledged by Lee at the time. On his way to the camps of Loring Wise and these other guys that are out there, Lee writes a letter back to his wife and says, in essence, that the mission that he is on is insane. He uses the word. If anybody would have told me that I'd be on this road, on this mission that I am on right now, I would have thought them to be insane. And it even gets worse. After he comes back from Western Virginia, Davis sends him down to the southeastern coast. Lee insists on having some kind of command authority, and he gets it. But on the train ride down there, he writes a letter to his daughter and says, this is even worse than the other mission, you know. And he uses very strong language about it. When things go very badly for the Confederates in early 62, the hue and the cry from the Confederate Congress comes up that what in the world is a full general doing down there doing the engineer's work on the southeastern coast? Why is he not commanding troops in the field? Davis is forced to recall Lee to Richmond. He does this on March the 2nd. Once Lee arrives at the Capitol, he cools his heels for 10 days and Davis does nothing about it. In the meantime, the Confederate Congress has drafted a bill for the rank of commanding general of the armies, which everybody expects Lee to be the person that occupies that office. But Davis sends the bill back unsigned, saying that it intrudes on his privileges as commander-in-chief. Everybody knows that Lee eventually became that commanding officer or commanding general of the armies, but it was January 65, long after the issue had been decided. So having convinced enough people in the Confederate Congress that Lee would have a position of importance on his staff, the veto cannot override his objection. So Lee is caught now again in a position of no authority. He lets everybody know about it privately, that he is beyond frustrated. And finally, he gets his chance when that arching shelf tracks that shelf fragment rips into Joe Johnston at the Battle of Seven Pines on May 31, 62. At that point in time, Davis has no alternative but to elevate Lee to Army Command. The reason he never got his chance, the man that Abraham Lincoln's administration would have placed, the principal army of the federal government under his command, that guy didn't get his chance to command an army until 14 months after the war. And if you look at the war very carefully and the principal army of the Confederacy and how it was not up to speed as it should have been organizationally, discipline-wise, and other, you can make the argument that that 14 years cost the Republic its chance for independence had Lee been in command from the get-go. So the answer is, the reason Lee didn't get his chance is because of politics involving the feud between Winfield Scott and Jeff Davis that dated back to the Mexican War. But that kind of is the story in a nutshell. I hope that answers it. I'm sorry it was so long, but that was, to be thorough, that's what it was. Thank you.
All right, sir. Going. Okay. All right, next question for Dr. Rosa. On the 28th of November, 1861, the Confederate Congress admitted the state of Missouri as the 12th state of the Confederacy. The bill was signed by President Davis and returned the next day. Question, how is it that Missouri would be need to be, quotated, readmitted to the Confederacy?
I know that, and I have another part of my presentation where to show that the Confederacy was amenable to secession and that Missouri left the Confederacy, rejoined the United States, and that was welcomed back in. So it was just editing for brevity purposes. It's not as though I didn't know that Missouri was considered to be, at least from the Confederate perspective, in the Union. But I just cut that out because I left out the part of the state seceding and then coming back in.
All right, this next question is open to all. Looking backwards and witnessing what Washington, D.C. has become, what is the point of 13 colonies seceding from the British Empire in 1776?
What's the question again, Adam?
Looking backwards and witnessing what Washington, D.C. has become, what is the point of 13 colonies seceding from the British Empire in 1776? I'm asking any of y'all.
Well, I will give it a stand. I think behind that question is the idea that we've been better off under the British, as the Canadians were, and New Zealand. The British were not unreasonable. They repealed the Stamp Act once the noise started, right away. They were authoritarian, but all the monarchies were. They were the most liberal. There's a case to be made for that. But I favor a secession of the colonies, and I like the government that the founders established. See, when you have a federal system such as the Americans worked out, you're going to have a problem because the states are sovereign, the central government has delegated powers, and you've always got the question of where the dividing line is and who's going to decide what powers belong to what agency. Every federal system has that problem. The EU has it. Any federal system will have that problem because the units could be independent. So there's always a centrifugal pull that way. and I sent a couple of people the other way. So, what happens? There are two things that can happen. One is that the center will get more power and eventually turn the states into sort of counties. And you can see the Federation of Germany. In 1700, Germany was made up of 230 countries. There was no state of Germany. It was just all these little states. And the central governments got more and more power, and the states have gotten absorbed more and more. But the German states still have a lot of autonomy. Switzerland, the small states have kept enormous autonomy. They keep the central government under control. Now, in America, the other thing that can happen is it comes apart. In other words, if the center gets too concentrated, then the states pull out and renegotiate. That's what should have happened. Had the Confederacy been left alone, it would have been like Switzerland today. Remember, Switzerland was modeled, in part, on America in 1848. Right? And they've continued. I mean, they're the same as they were, pretty much, in 1848. Every male has a fully automatic, from 18 to 40-something, has a fully automatic assault rifle, is in the militia. You can buy anti-tank weapons in Switzerland. You want your citizens to have anti-tank weapons, don't you? and with a license, you can buy artillery. So Switzerland is, you know, it's survived since 1291, and in a Europe of centralized regimes, World War I, World War II, all that stuff flying over them, they've maintained this Jeffersonian-style federation, which they formed in 1848. Now, had the South been left alone, all the indications, Constitution and all the rest of it, and Marshall DeRosa's imaginary address to Congress bears this out, would have probably gone that way. Why wouldn't it? I mean, it rigged the rules in such a way that it would be very difficult to centralize power. And you can see that in the Confederate Constitution. And had they even halfway stuck to that, they would have gone off on a completely different trajectory. When people say that kind of government couldn't exist, in Switzerland, it exists in Switzerland. And they in part got it from us. Why couldn't it exist here? We had the kind of people to do it. So I very much approve of the American secession from Britain, and the South secession from the United States.
You might also want to ask an Irishman that question. or a Scotsman. I mean, think about the English system and the stratification of classes. Even the US and the federal constitution, no titles of nobility. There's a distinction between human beings in those systems. As I mentioned in the Declaration, it's great that we seceded, not only for economic reasons, you made a strong economic case. The secession was a pragmatic move. But just the elevation of the human condition, the human spirit. It was the United States and the freedom of the United States and the unleashing of the human spirit. For example, around 1700, the average life expectancy was 25 to 35 years of age. And what is it today? Most of that comes from the United States and the economic engine and the elevation of people's living standards and conditions. I don't know if that would necessarily be the case if we were still part of an empire, because our secession also had an impact on English and British behavior. So the United States, why secede? To liberate the human spirit, freedom. And if we had it, we may have lost it, and we probably have a good portion of it. But we still have enough arrows in our quiver to regain it. And that goes back to this notion, every man a king. Don't be tricked into this notion that you're subject. And then the government, they own you. You owe them obedience unconditionally, because that's the status quo today. Those are these findings.
I might just add one thing. The Canadian slogan is peace, order, and good government. The American is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Two different ways of thinking about it.
This is open to all. Does secession always mean armed resistance? If not, what are the alternatives?
In the United States, it should not be armed resistance. It's a political process, and it should be a peaceful process. If it means armed resistance, if that's what it means, that's even a stronger reason to secede.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If you can't do it peacefully, Houston, we have a problem.
I'd like to add something to that, if I might.
Absolutely.
First of all, we've had many, many years, those of us who are old enough to remember the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall, the problem with it was not that it kept people out. A lot of us wish for another wall to keep people out. But that it kept people in. And the United States has a wall around it right now. It merely keeps states in. And I've never seen any caged animal that was happy. To compare us to the British colonies who did not separate from Great Britain, first of all, I would not want to live in camp. There are many reasons why. One is that I'd be in prison because there's certain things that you can't say in camp. This conference here today, most of you all would be in prison.
Yep, that's right.
And that's the case in Australia also. That I've lived all over the world, and I'd say that you cannot achieve the kind of freedom that we achieved in some areas and still have today. Look at the gun laws in other countries. So definitely we needed our freedom from Great Britain. Then the question comes up, well, look at where we are today. Well, you can't really judge something by looking back today as to whether it was right then. Because for 70 years, it was the greatest nation on the earth with the most promising prospects on the face of the earth. It just started to fall apart. And it did not start to fall apart because I disagree with you a ton on that, because of centrifugal or the opposite forces. It began to fall apart because of one man named Abraham Lincoln. And he even had trouble mobilizing anybody on his side. And you can't look forward in time to that. If you do that, every single political action taken today, you've got to look forward 150 years into the future to see what result. You can't do that. You just have to set the best system in motion that you can at that time and hope that your descendants will follow Benjamin Franklin's advice and hold on to their republic. You cannot account for your great-great-great-grandchildren, especially not when they're born $1 million in debt, which they will be to other countries.
Just a word on secession and resistance. One of the things we need to understand is that the concept of secession was just so I'll put this, it's only recently, it's been a smear term, it's been something bad. And the reason is the idea of the modern state is that it's one and indivisible, right? I mean, the French Revolutionary State is that way, they're all one and indivisible. Well, if they were indivisible, how are you going to have secession? Because that's the divider. You can only do it through violence. See, so the idea of secession got to be understood to be violence dividing the indivisible. You see? To give you an example of this, when I started thinking about these things right after the Soviet Union divided through peace, relatively peacefully through secession. Being a philosopher, I looked at the Philosopher's Index, which publishes all articles in philosophy from 1940 until today in five languages. And I looked up the articles with the titles for the word secession of the articles. There are only seven. And five were on the only book written by in English by a philosopher on secession called Secession from Fort Sumter to Lithuania. There were five book reviews on that. It was five of the seven. And then two articles on Quebec's vote on secession in 1995. And now think about that. Philosophers have written about every crazy thing you can think of. The timers on the wheel, the people on the wheel, all sorts of things, but not secession. Why? Because so deeply was ingrained this modern notion that the state is indivisible and that the state is the instrument of civilization that it simply was not on the radar screen. Today it is. And that is I've seen in my lifetime, that is a revolution. People say, well, Scotland's having a vote on secession. Catalonia just voted on secession. Veneto region in Italy voted on secession. People are taking this as if this is a policy that could be carried out with prudence, and it might happen, it might not. Whereas before it was absolutely forbidden, such that even the philosophers couldn't think of to write anything about it. So that's a big change. Secession is not something that involves violence. Secession is one political society, for whatever reason, connected to another, deciding to negotiate a separation. Norway seceded from Sweden in 1905. There wasn't any war. Belgium seceded from the Netherlands in 1835. Singapore seceded from Malaysia in 1965. So the world has changed. And we can now talk about this sort of thing without violence, and we need to understand the history of the world.
Can I add one more?
Yeah.
Just one more comment I'm gonna make. A lot of y'all either teach or friends ask you. I've always had students ask me, you know, what was the cause of secession and the war? And I always have to ask them, which secession or the war? They're two completely different things. The cause of secession are many, but they needn't be anything, it can just be one. The causes of war are a very serious choice. And that choice was not made by the South. The South chose to secede. It never chose to go to war. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
Scott? Okay. This is to all. How did Lincoln justify his prior stance to a people should only choose, I'm having trouble reading that, and have the right to dissolve their form of government and start one that suits them?
Read the first part of it.
Okay. How did Lincoln justify his prior stance that people shall only choose, have the right to dissolve their government, form of government?
I didn't like that, but I know what he said. That's that Lincoln, when he was in Congress, 1848. Any people at any time have a right to dissolve one government, form a new one. They have better troops. They'll remember the famous Lincoln statement. I think that's what they're saying.
Yeah, and that means we use the word "we have the power to do it."
Yes. Lincoln thought of, in the first inaugural, Lincoln says, "Secession is anarchy." He says, quote, "the essence of secession is anarchy." So he's thinking of government as being a modern unitary state, one and indivisible. The people who think that way think that's the way government is. Any government should be that way. Okay. So what he means by revolution in that 1848, what he means by secession is, he doesn't use the word secession. But he means revolution. And this means, like the French Revolution, you have a modern unitary state, right? One and indivisible. But if the individuals in it are dissatisfied, if they have the power, they can overthrow it. That's what he means. He just means revolution, which would include terrorism or anything else, because you're going into a state of nature, which is anarchy. Revolution is anarchy. And you win, then you got your government. It's that sort of thing. But that's not secession. Secession is one political society connected with another, withdrawing. Just withdrawing. That's a serious thing to do, but it's not a revolution.
Okay. Well, good. This one's for you.
Oh.
Why did Robert E. Lee's hatred for the British originate? Where did R. E. Lee's hatred for the British originate?
Oh, let me guess, his father. Sound reasonable? I enjoy reading his different letters where he refers to the Federals as the British, or as the Philistines, or as those people. But yeah, I believe with his connection with his the Washington side of the family, with the history that his own father had with in the American Revolution, that he had an appreciation for the depth of conviction that the forefathers had in fighting the evil empire.
Just one brief thing on that. You got to remember, Americans had a cold relation with the British right on up to 1860. I mean, they had the War of 1812. The British was a threat in Canada, Oregon, and all of that. The British were messing around with Texas when Texas was independent. It was only in World War I that we began to be friendly to the British. And a lot of Americans were pro-German in World War I.
One other thing.
Just one comment that I'd like to add is one thing. Britain changed fundamentally in 1649, 1650, and Cromwell was the closest British exemplar to Lincoln. Tyranny of the British Commonwealth so resembled, was almost a prototype for the Lincoln administration. I mean, would you agree with that, disagree?
Yes. There's an interesting book by a woman named Ann Norton called Alternative Americans. And what she studies are the conceptions that Southerners had of themselves and that Northerners had of themselves and that they had of each other in popular literature. In poems, songs, or journal articles, and so on. This is just popular culture. And in that popular culture, the Northerners identified themselves with Cromwell and the Puritan Revolution, the Roundheads. Not all of them, but a lot of them did. And Southerners identified themselves with the Cavaliers and the Royals. And this was all over the place. And Lincoln was called Cromwell, and so on. So I think that is part of. I mean, Lee is inherited that memory. Americans were fighting the English Civil War all over again, in the way they fought.
One thing to follow up, Dr. Livingston's mention of the British and American relations. I don't think we can forget in World War I. Just how much money we loaned the Brits and the French. And those loans were in serious danger of defaulting. They would have defaulted had the Germans won. And with the rumors on the mill that Lenin was going to be released and let loose in Russia, with the imminent collapse of the Eastern Front, and with being able to forecast that far into advance, I think it was a given that America entered the war on the side of the Brits and the French, and it was because of money, serious money. And yes, it's very true. There were lots of German Americans and a lot of volunteers, I know from Texas, went to fight for the German army. But I think anytime you look at America's entry into the war, you have to look at the financial aspects of it.
Oh, is James Newsom in here tonight? Okay. This is for everyone. What do you think would have happened if the Scottish people had voted for independence in 2014?
Ooh. I spent a lot of time in Scotland, and I remember I started going there in 75, and I watched this nationalist party grow. I'm in favor of secession generally and so on, but I must say an independent Scotland would be a very socialist, leftist Scotland, and I'm still happy for them to succeed. But my main argument against that is the Parliament building they built in Edinburgh. If anybody's ever seen it, the cost was outlandish, and it is, they stayed up late at night trying to design the most perverse building they could think of to ruin the royal mind. And the people who do that probably shouldn't be governing themselves.
Dr. Livingston, you suggested that Article 5 might be a good way to remedy our current problems. Are you concerned that our current politicians would throw out the current Constitution just as they did in 200 years ago? Do you trust the current politicians to approve the situation?
Good question. Well, the Supreme Court throws it out every time they meet, so it's not as if it was safe anyway. But I think the states have ample ways to block that. They can require that the convention be for one topic only or whatever. You just need, what, how many states to block that? One quarter of the states. So I think there are mechanisms can be worked out to make that viable. One of the things we need to think about is that you know, we hear about red states and blue states. That's not really the way it is. What you have is Chicago is blue, but the rest of Illinois is red. So you have that sort of thing. Now who controls the legislature of Illinois? Well, sometimes it's the reds. And so if you look at the legislatures of the states and governors, there are a lot of red legislatures. So shift your attention away from Washington and just start looking at the states.
Yeah.
And so imagine now two-thirds of the states holding a convention and putting in place certain amendments. And let's suppose that instead of throwing our energies into national elections, which are a fool's errand, throw our energies into restructuring our state legislatures and building institutions to connect the states. They're disconnected. They're even in the 10th Amendment movements and so on. I'm working with some legislators in Oklahoma, a number of us in the Institute are, in South Carolina, and have testified in one of those legislatures. But those active people sometimes don't know what the other states are doing. But if they did, if the states were conservative, or a certain region of them were conservative, and using Article 5, we could get some amendments that could really alter things, and they would come from the legislatures, the people. If you try to amend the Constitution through Congress, forget it. There have been over 10,000 amendments proposed, according to William Quirk, a constitutional scholar, over 10,000 amendments proposed to the Constitution, to Congress. Only 32 have ever left the gate. So the answer is no. Congress is never going to let anything through. So you have to go through the state legislatures. And that has never been tried. We need to try it. So all this fear about what will happen with the Constitutional Convention, I think, is bogus. there are many safeguards that can be set up. We should enthusiastically support that. Do you know how powerful the states are? I mean, they could really change the Constitution. But we need to get control of the states. You want blue state, red states legislatures do it.
Thank you. Has there ever been a court comment regarding the constitutional reception of, wait a second, the conditional rectification? Sorry, I can't.
Comment regarding the constitutional ratification of the Constitution by the states.
Right.
Oh, good question.
Okay. Has there ever been a court comment regarding the constitutional ratification of the conditional ratification of the Constitution by the states of New York, Virginia, and Rhode Island? Does international law speak to this issue?
Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York had a conditional ratification.
They did, but Madison did, and others. And they just say, well, once you're ready, you're in, for the most part. But even though they did either explicitly or implicitly, it doesn't need to be in the ratification document, because if you were to do a survey of the ratifiers when the Constitution was being voted on, they would probably say, of course, if this doesn't work out, we can leave, because they saw themselves as, quote, sovereign political unit. So the conditional ratification of the three states, I don't recall, well, I don't think the court had to speak on it, because it was never an issue in any case that was pending or decided by the court that I could think of. It certainly wasn't in Texas v. White, it wasn't raised. In that decision, Chief Justice Chase just used the Lincolnian argument that it's revolution. They didn't even acknowledge secession as a political process, withdrawing one's assent to the Union. And Chase says effectively, or essentially, that as Lincoln and others, and that if your secession is successful revolution, then you succeed in your leaders or heroes. If they fail, they are traitors and rebels. So.
Dr. DeRosa, the states can set their voter eligibility. Isn't peaceful reorganization a catch-22?
What's that again? The states can... set their voter eligibility.
Okay, if states can set voter eligibility, isn't peaceful reorganization a catch-22? Well, I don't necessarily understand the question. If they can or can't?
It says just can't set.
Oh yeah, it says.
So if that says cannot set.
Well, I guess from a theoretical point of view, that would be up to the states. But it's not up to the states anymore because of national statutory requirements. But typically, the states would decide citizenship, not naturalization, but citizenship, and they would also, they could constrain certain citizens to leave voting under certain conditions. But the Constitution uses the word person, and that's one of the issues that probably will be before the courts not too long, and I think this is what the amnesty crowd is hoping for, especially the Democrats, that once you give some form of legal status to a illegal alien or undocumented worker, whatever you want to call the individual, then you will have to give them voting eligibility within the states. And that's why, for example, I was speaking to the previous speaker earlier this morning. You secessionists, something to rattle the cage of the ruling class. But I tend to disagree with that, because if you continue to call bluff, nobody's going to take that bluff seriously. And secondly, we are at a point, a tipping point, in American political development where the demographics are changing so rapidly, the culture is changing, that there might come a point in time that if the Constitution were amended, that the state of Texas, if it wanted to, may secede. It probably, or may not, depending upon political cultural developments, decide not to secede. Or if it does secede, it'll secede and join Mexico. That's why this, you know, conferences like this, it's up to the people, but the people need to wake up. They need to understand that there is a ruling class with centralized political authority, not only over the economy, but also over the minds of Americans. And if something doesn't happen soon, we're going to go on that tipping point in the wrong direction. And that doesn't mean some cataclysmic event might not happen, like a total collapse of the economy. But man, we are really joined at the hip, sort of like multiple Siamese twins, to this leviathan. So timing is essential. And even with nullification and such, if you nullify this or that law or interpose, that might buy you some time. But the, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but if you were to do a trend analysis, the hour is late. And secession shouldn't be used as a bluff. It should be used as a real viable option to secure your freedom and independence from what I consider to be an increasingly tyrannical centralized authority. So voter eligibility, that's just one little link in this ongoing chain. Because you will see people that today aren't eligible to vote, within a few election cycles, they will be voted. And you can see that with the new Secretary of Housing at the national level. They know what they're doing by placing immigrants in certain key congressional districts to change the outcome of elections in pivotal states, what we call today swing states. So you're being hit on all sides, and most people don't even realize it. Someday you're going to wake up and say, what in the heck happened?
No, read that real quick. This is from the fellow last night. I just remember they asked me how else we're going to jump.
Question for James Wilson.
Yeah.
Oh. Last evening you noted you broke with political correctness, quote, to hell with it, and therefore became active in SCV. Please be graphic in describing what entry or mid-level career academics and universities would confront if they are outspoken advocates of principles and values promoted by the SCV.
Do y'all have any opinion on that?
Good. So he wants to know what academics would suffer in the university if they came up.
Yes, sir.
Well, I gave papers on secession and the like, and nothing happened to me. The SCV, I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center tried to cause some ruckus at Emory, but it didn't go anywhere, so I don't know.
I don't know if on the level of mid-level academic career. I was an assistant professor at West Point, and But I was in the Army at the time, captain in the Army. And so naturally, I couldn't very well succeed and remain there. However, when I finished up there, I put out feelers. I had an National Review magazine, which was the only thing around at that time, for a position in history. Aaron Stretz put my field was American history or European history, not military history. And I stressed that I preferred to go to Texas, the university in Texas, but at least in the South, I got over 40 responses of a promotion to associate professor at 40 different colleges and universities, but every one of them was in the North. And I checked them out anyway. And I thought, well, if they read that magazine, they can't be too far. But I found out in several cases, I was asked not only what party I was in, but how I voted specifically. And then I was introduced to the faculty. The faculty didn't have any interest whatsoever as to whether I'd ever taken a course in history. All they were interested in were my political views. Now, I was coach for the West Point debate team when we were world champions and when we were U.S. champions. When we debated Yale and Harvard, they tried to keep the West Point debate team out, but they couldn't since we were, you know, in the finals. So they allowed the West Point debate team in. Then when they found out that all but one of my debaters were from the South, then they said, well, at least the team is led by one of us, a Northerner, you, Mr. Tausch. Sorry, I'm from the South. And I was promptly told that, well, please don't ever expect to get any praise from our debate coaches or judges. We won anyway. But don't expect any praise. And don't come back to our campus afterwards if you ever leave West Point. And don't come back to our campus. When I decided at some point to become a lawyer and come back home, take up the family ranch sort of thing, and thought, while at the time, getting my feet wet, that I teach at UTSA, the University of Texas in San Antonio, they have a downtown campus. I was flatly told when I applied there that they had read some of my articles, and that one, I was of the wrong ethnic group. And two, my articles would guarantee I would never get tenure and would never rise whatsoever, and that I was not welcome to teach in San Antonio. And San Antonio, all the colleges are all run by one board, whether private, Catholic colleges, Trinity University, University of Texas, San Antonio, they're all run by one board. They hire everybody as a board and issue them out to the different universities. So I knew that my academic career was through, absolutely. I went ahead and I taught at UT for a while and also, but I knew that it was through in San Antonio. So I can only say at my minimum, that might not be true for full professors or department heads or something. It might not be true for contract employee assistant or instructors, but at my particular level, it was deadly to even be known you were from the South unless you spent all of your time denouncing the South. For example, they're perfectly willing to take the writer of The Strange Career of Jim Crow. He was a Southerner. But they were willing to take him because he denounced the South sufficiently when he applied. I was not willing to do that. And so it is the killer, and you have to pretty well decide to go in another line of work than academia in my level. I cannot say that for tenured professor Jeb Adicott, our speaker earlier today, is fortunate he has tenure. If he didn't have tenure, he could never have spoken here today. And even now, they're beginning to jerk tenure for that sort of thing. If I were in academia, I would not be here. But I have no idea about people to the high celestial levels that Dr. Livingston's reached.
I should have added that my field is philosophy and the Scottish Enlightenment, that sort of thing. It's not Southern history, it's not American history. I never wrote anything on that. So I came in on the blind side, so to speak. But I did write on secession and federalism, that sort of thing. I wrote about it, you know, in a theoretical way that was acceptable. I knew how to do that. But yes, had I written articles about, had I been in history or something, that would have been a different thing. But it is bad. It really is. You have to be very careful, as if you were in the court of the Borgias. my wife taught at Clemson in philosophy department, and there was a fellow interviewed who was from the South, and in the department meeting, and everybody there was a Yankee except one person, and maybe he had left by then, I don't know, but anyway, somebody in the department said, well, as long as I'm here, nobody's going to be hired with a Southern accent.
Yeah.
So you could just, so she wasn't from the South herself, but that gives you some idea. Not every place is that bad, but it's just really, you said we're going to wake up one day and wonder what happened. That happened to me 20 years ago.
Just one more thing. I don't know how many people know this, because I don't know how many people have been so unfortunate as to be sunk in academia. But, you know, it is the faculty who determines your promotions, and they do it by vote. It's the faculty who determines your tenure, and they do it by vote. And quite simply, if the majority of the faculty disagrees with your politics, or your social views, or anything else, it doesn't make any difference how much publication publish or perish, or how many credits you've gotten, or awards you've gotten, or God knows what Pulitzers you've gotten. If the majority of the faculty votes you don't get tenure, you don't get tenure. If the majority of the faculty votes you don't get promoted, you don't get promoted. And you can find out what the majority of your faculty thinks by going to your nearest college and dropping in on a faculty lounge, find some excuse to be invited. And just listen to them talk, and you can hear their views, and you know that if you ever open your mouth, I suppose somebody could lie and cheat their way through. Even one famous radio announcer keeps telling students at universities, well, just give the professor back what he wants for 4 years and get your degree, and then go out and tell the truth. Well, by that time, you've been a double agent so long that you generally tend to believe what your professor tells you. So you've got to start fighting from the beginning. And the difficulty is that since 1965, the faculties have been taken over by the far left, period. And you can either fight them. I fought them in the 60s and 70s. You can just drop out. You can do anything you want to. Do recall that if you play double agent too many years, it's like sleeper agents. The Soviets lost half their sleeper agents over here because they simply decided they want to stay here and they liked the American way. And if you're a sleeper agent at a major university, you might get by a year holding to your own views, but you gradually open your mind to their views, and by the end of the time, you're out there rioting, and
you know, I used to tell people that the fact that I was tenured and promoted to full professor early in my career is another ontological proof of the existence of God, because I am thankful, because it is a blessing. To be an academic is a privilege. It's a great life. You pay for what you love doing. But a lot of it goes, I have to admit, yes, the left is taking over the universities. But who owns the universities? The people of the respective states, if it's a public university. And yeah, I could have walked away and be intimidated, but I fought. People knew that if they crossed the Rosa, DeRosa's going to meet them head on. And that's the type of attitude, academician. Maybe we just don't attract buyers to the academy. Maybe we attract the wrong kind of people to the academy. But I was never shy. I never hid who I was and who I am. And it didn't matter that too much to me. They didn't like me, I'd tell them to buzz off and I'll go do something else. But a lot of the faculty members, I've seen them, and I've seen people being weeded out in the hiring process and everything else. And maybe we have reached a point where the universities are so corrupt, not only in the social sciences and humanities, but in the hard sciences. It's not only the universities, it's the private sector. Same thing in the corporate world, in the business world. You don't have the right attitudes and the right point of view for a particular company. There are consequences for that. But I don't know. It just seems to have this, not to say that I wasn't denied jobs. I didn't go on interviews for other positions, and I was turned down because of my gender, my race, my political beliefs, my scholarship. But I wouldn't blame the universities. They've had a free ride. Usually it's because people have not challenged them on their corrupt way of hiring and or firing faculty members. Is tenure a good or bad thing? At what point in time it was good? It's reached the point now where it's a Full Employment Act for people normally to persecute other people without tenure and for employment for life. But that's another area where the universities become a Trojan horse of socialization, especially in the South, against things that this group believes in and wants to promote. So I won't just take it as a fait accompli, even though that is the status quo. We should ask ourselves, what can I do about it? Do I make contributions to the university from which I graduated and they're using those contributions to corrupt the culture? I mean, where's the responsibility? You tell me.
Having said all this, let me just say one thing. We encourage people to try to get jobs in university and colleges. I mean, as you said, this is true everywhere, the corporate world, wherever you go. So our students are going to the universities and they need to be taught by good teachers. And so we just have to get in there and learn how to behave and work so that we can flourish it. And it can be done.
Happened at Washington and Lee, where the students are demanding of the university that they desecrate Lee's tomb. What happened there? The students are teaching the teachers. Or is it the faculty is allowing that to happen and putting pressure on the president?
Well, those students are being taught in the high schools by professors or teachers that came out of the universities. It's a cycle, a symbiotic relationship. And don't think it's the students' initiative necessarily. There are instructors and professors. I was up there and I talked in July, but there are instructors behind the scenes agitating the students to do the dirty work. So that just shows you what an institution like Washington and Lee, University of the South, Vanderbilt, Texas A&M, University of Texas, wow, then you should talk. I mean, professor's right, sitting on some of these. Do you think they hold you? You're the unwashed masses. It's sort of like the, think about the culture. People like us, we're just kind of, you want to plow a field and you have all these tree stumps, they're too difficult to dig up, so you just bide your time and wait out. The tree stump eventually rots and fertilizes the ground for the crop you want to bring up. That's what I'm saying. Think about this. Texas secedes, and the people of Texas take over their public universities. Who are you hiring to teach you in universities? How many citizens are involved in that hiring and promotion process? Who hires your university president, the provost? That is an entity it's like a walled city. You don't know what's going on, but they're sending out these apparatchiks
generation after generation after generation that are transforming your society. So that, you know, you know, I don't know what to say.
It's like a bunch of Lincolns all over the place.
They're worse than Lincoln, because Lincoln wouldn't buy into some of the garbage they're being taught today. I don't think. They're Lincolns on steroids, without even realizing. But, you know, we're in a heap of trouble. That's why I use the secession as a, to rattle the cage. They don't care, they could care less, unless you're serious about doing something. If you want to be free, you want to preserve your culture, you want to preserve your Christian civilization, the hour's late, that's all I have to say.
Let me throw in one thing. There's one aspect of academia nobody's considered, and that's law schools. Jeff Addicott teaches at St. Mary's. I've been an adjunct professor of constitutional law. Stick to the law. Be amenable to the faculty. You will get tenure. Once you get tenure, constitutional law is a wonderful place for Southerners to go. It's about the only field of law. The others are great, I mean, but teaching wills in a state is not too much for our cause. But constitutional law is a perfect option for our cause. And you can get tenure at law schools if that is the branch of academia you're going to. Unfortunately, you have to become a lawyer first. But
on your question about William and Mary, there were a few students. A few students, but it was administration. And I think Marshall's right about that. I first started teaching in the late 60s when the so-called student riots were going on all over the place. Students, that's all you heard about, students were riot, students were upset. Well, the majority of college students voted for Nixon during that time. And I said, look, I see a lot of faculty unrest, a lot of administrative unrest, but I don't see much student unrest, really. I mean, there are a few students, but so there's the apparatchiks that Marshall was talking about, but and you see it in corporate America too. You can do the same thing in corporate America. There's a Confederate symbol around some corporation, a few people raise a fuss about it, they cave in. So it's a cultural war, and you just have to fight it. That president had the opportunity to do a teaching and say, well, okay, there's a controversy. Let's have people that respect Lee and all explain why they want this tradition maintained and educate people, but he didn't do that.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate everybody coming out today. We're gonna have to vacate the room so they can get it ready for the festivities tonight. We're gonna start at 6:00, the doors will open, there'll be a cash bar available, and then the schedule will follow after that. The lovely and gracious Kathleen Hines will be speaking to us this evening. She's in here right now, and so we'll get have a good talk from her this evening. And I'd like to thank y'all for coming today and participating. Appreciate it. Thank the panel also for all y'all's input and help.
Thank you. Thank you.